It's the NPR News Update for Tuesday, October 1st. I'm Phil Picardi with Minnesota News. Lots of it today. We start with a high-profile resignation. After 10 years as the music director and conductor of the Minnesota Orchestra, Osmo Venska has resigned. This after another breakdown in the contract talks between management of the orchestra and its players. Morning Edition host Kathy Werzer read from Venska's statement of resignation this morning.
Today, I've given notice of my resignation as music director and conductor for the Minnesota Orchestra Association effective 1 October 2013. It's a very sad day for me. Over 10 years, I was honored to be invited to take up this position. I moved from Finland to the Twin Cities. At that time, I made clear my belief that the Minnesota Orchestra could become one of the very greatest international ensembles. During the intervening years, I've had the privilege of seeing that belief vindicated through the skill, hard work, and commitment of this wonderful group of players, with the valued support of the board of directors, management, and administration team, volunteers, as well as our exceptional community. I send my deepest thanks to everyone involved for what we have achieved together, and I wish the Minnesota Orchestra all the very best for its future. Joining me now with more is Minnesota Public Radio reporter Ewan Carey, has been following the situation with the Minnesota Orchestra and the labor situation there. Well, Ewan, this is exactly what Osmo Venska said he was going to do.
Indeed, he did.
What happened yesterday to bring this to a boil?
Basically, after 17 months, the musicians who have been locked out actually for a year as of today offered two counterproposals. These are the first solid counterproposals they've offered in the entire time. Management looked at them, apparently it took less than an hour, and they said these are wholly inadequate. We need to be saving a lot more money than we save under your suggestions. As a result, they said we can't wait anymore on these Carnegie shows, which are in the beginning of November, and so they canceled them, knowing that Osmo Venska would very likely resign as a result.
What has Osmo Venska said about the reason the Carnegie Hall concerts were so important to him?
Well, I talked to him a couple of years ago, and he said that basically he saw three legs in the orchestral chair. The first was rehearsing again and again and again to get a little better each time. Then let's listen to what else he said.
We have to be able to do recordings which are so good that they will get international attention. And then the third thing is we had to be able to go out from home to do national and international touring to prove that what people are listening from the recordings is true.
So the concerts at Carnegie were to be Sibelius. He is a world-renowned Sibelius expert, and he saw these concerts as being pivotal both to his own career and to that of the orchestra. And given that they're not happening, he felt he had no other alternative.
And of course, the ongoing lockout then continues with the musicians. What's the status of the dispute?
Well, as they've been saying for months, both sides say they're ready to talk, although they're clearly a long way apart. And now that the pressure point of Osmo Venska's departure is no longer there, some feel there's a chance that this could now go on for a long time.
Mm. Now, there was some talk, Ewan, about the musicians playing Carnegie with Venska, but not as the Minnesota Orchestra. Is that a possibility?
Well, that came up again yesterday during the press conference by the musicians. They say that they want to take Osmo Venska to Carnegie because it is so important for them. They have set up their own independent fall season,
yes.
And they say over the next few weeks they will explore the possibility of doing that. Of course, it's a huge effort that takes a lot of backing.
That's Ewan Care and Kathy Werzer on Morning Edition. Federal government workers are finding out if they are essential today. After Congress could not agree on a stopgap spending bill last night, the government began a partial shutdown. What does that mean for Minnesota? Here's Mark Zedeklik.
At least initially, things will feel more the same than different. That's what University of Minnesota political science professor Larry Jacobs says.
For most people, the shutdown, if it's short, will be a big theater in D.C., but little impact back home.
Airports will still be open. Federal food safety and inspection programs will continue. The post office will still deliver mail, and Social Security and Medicare benefits will still be there. But if you're one of roughly 19,000 federal employees in Minnesota who does not work for the post office, you might be sent home to wait out the shutdown. That's what Julie Galanska faces. She handles media relations and several other jobs for the St. Croix National Scenic Riverway. It's one of six national parks in Minnesota. Galanska and almost all of the other Park Service employees are categorized as non-essential. They'll be sidelined if the federal government shuts down.
We remain hopeful that the federal government is not going to shut down.
Galanska says six National Park Service law enforcement officers who work on the St. Croix National Scenic Riverway will remain on the job. But the park's two interpretive centers will be closed. So will all of the other facilities, including popular campsites along 230 miles of the Namaqaugan and Upper St. Croix Rivers. Galanska says that could affect thousands of people.
We are at the height of fall color season right now, or just about to approach it. So it does have an impact on our visitors. I checked on our visitation last October, and at the Riverway, we had almost 7,000 visitors. Most of those have, you know, coming during the first half of the month for peak fall color.
Canceling visits to national parks won't be the only problem you might encounter in a shutdown. You'll still have to pay your taxes, but if you have questions about them, no one from the IRS will be available to answer them. And if you want a new passport or to apply for a visa, you'll have to wait. If you need a replacement Social Security card, you'll be out of luck. For most people, all of that might seem fairly trivial, at least in the short term. But Marketplace Money Economics editor Chris Farrell says the brinksmanship isn't doing the economy any good. Even if you don't work for the federal government, don't like national parks, or don't need tax questions answered, Farrell says it's hurting you.
Here's the real question. Who isn't being hired because business is unsure about what's going to happen? What capital projects aren't being invested in because of this rising uncertainty? We have this weak recovery. It's a disappointing recovery. It just simply adds to the momentum toward a weak recovery.
Farrell says people should be angry that the federal government has become so dysfunctional. That's how Marilyn Chesnick and Jerry Dorf feel. They own and operate Wild River Outfitters along the St. Croix River in Grantsburg, Wisconsin. They're worried business will drop off and that the riverway won't be properly maintained.
Certainly. I mean, it's just
absolutely. I'm furious that these outfits that we elect cannot come together and be reasonable.
It's unbelievable. This is another example, another situation where our federal government, the Congress and Senate, are not able to do the people's business. And that is not only irritating, I'm just kind of outraged, kind of really mad at them for not taking care of their job.
It's not clear who Americans will blame if the government shuts down. Conservative Tea Party-backed Republicans have opposed passing a continuing resolution to fund government operations without tying it to changes in the Affordable Care Act. According to a Gallup poll released late last week, about 22% of Americans support the Tea Party. That's down from 32% in the fall of 2010, when the Tea Party was at the height of its popularity following its emergence in opposition to Obamacare.
Mark Zedeklik on the NPR News Update. The state's new online health insurance marketplace, MinSure, goes live this afternoon, but officials say one-on-one help for consumers won't be available until tomorrow. Executive Director April Todd Malmlove says MinSure still needs to certify designated helpers, including navigators and in-person assisters.
We need to verify that training has been completed and the tests have been passed. The background checks, also those going through, as well as checking licensure checks on brokers with the Department of Commerce as well. And so on Wednesday, as soon as individuals have passed those, it'll be a rolling process to get up. We will be updating that every day.
MinSure is asking American Indians to wait a week to enroll. Officials say they're not fully satisfied with the site's ability to process special provisions that apply to tribal members. As health insurance marketplaces go online, surveys indicate confusion abounds over how the so-called exchanges will work and who should use them. Elizabeth Stowicki says MinSure is not for everyone.
The opening of new health insurance marketplaces in every state represents a major milestone for the president's health care overhaul, a law which also requires most Americans to carry health insurance. So it's not hard to link the two and conclude that you have to get insurance on an exchange like Minnesota's MinSure. The truth is, some will have to, but most won't. Minnesota's Human Services Commissioner Lucinda Jessen says there are several specific groups that the state's new online insurance marketplace will serve.
Well, Minter will be very helpful for people who don't have health insurance today. It will also be a real option for people who are buying insurance through the individual market, especially for people who have pre-existing conditions.
Minsure is expecting to enroll about 1.3 million Minnesotans in commercial or government health plans by 2016. It's not clear how many will sign up for 2014. But about 8 out of every 10 Minnesotans projected to enroll through Minsure will enroll in public health programs such as Medicaid, called Medical Assistance in Minnesota, or MinnesotaCare. Jessen says many of those people are eligible to enroll in those plans now, but haven't done so.
We make it difficult currently for people to sign up and re-enroll because of all of the paperwork. And Minsure is going to really change that for people on public programs.
While those eligible for Medicaid and MinnesotaCare will enroll through Minsure, those in or eligible for Medicare will not. Medicare serves people age 65 and older or those who have disabilities.
If you are on the Medicare program, Minsure is not for you.
AARP Minnesota Executive Director Michelle Kimball. Kimball says there's been a lot of confusion among seniors because the Minsure and Medicare open enrollment periods overlap. Both have October start dates, although Medicare's open enrollment period doesn't begin until October 15th. Kimball says seniors should enroll in Medicare as they always do. In short, she says Medicare enrollees should ignore all the hoo-ha about Minsure, both for enrolling in Medicare itself, but also for supplemental coverage known as Medigap policies.
So if that is something they're thinking about, that they need to switch their Medigap policy, this is not the place to do it.
Kimball says if seniors have questions, they should call the Minnesota Board on Aging Senior Linkage Line. For people who have access to coverage through an employer, but that coverage is expensive, Minsure may offer an alternative. You can buy coverage on Minsure if you find a better deal, but there is a catch. It's much harder to qualify for federal subsidies that help you shoulder the cost. Only if your employer coverage costs you more than 9.5% of your income can you qualify for a federal insurance subsidy. For a household with the state's median income, that's about $460 a month. Employers are required to notify employees of their coverage options by October 1st, including coverage on state-run insurance marketplaces such as Minsure. But there is no penalty or fine if they don't. Carolyn Perry, CEO of the Minnesota Health Action Group and Employer Coalition, expects employee questions will ramp up in the coming weeks as the insurance marketplaces get up and running. She recommends workers talk to their HR departments if they have any questions about coverage.
Employers have been spending a lot of time on trying to figure out how, in fact, they're going to communicate this to the employees. They're just stepping into all their open enrollment information now. So now is the time you'd really want to talk to your human resource department to find out what you should be considering.
Experts also say that no one needs to decide whether to use Minsure on day one. Open enrollment on Minsure will run through the end of March, and there's no penalty for lacking insurance until then. Also, if you decide on one plan on Minsure and then change your mind, you can switch to another plan, as long as you do so during open enrollment. Elizabeth Stawicki, Minnesota Public Radio News.
A former top accountant for the Twin Cities Archdiocese is claiming church leaders have made payments to 9 priests involved in sexual misconduct. Scott Domeyer's attorney made the allegations yesterday after a Ramsey County judge sentenced Domeyer to 39 months in prison. Domeyer pleaded guilty to stealing more than $600,000 from the Archdiocese and filing improper tax returns. Tom Scheck reports.
Scott Domeyer's sentencing was a dry affair, where the attorneys focused mostly on the time he'll serve in prison and the amount of money he'll have to pay back to the Archdiocese. During those discussions, Domeyer's attorneys tried to introduce an exhibit that detailed his concerns about the payments to 9 priests. Judge Joanne Smith wouldn't allow the document to be discussed, but Domeyer's attorney later released it to the media. The memo, which was sent to lawyers for the Archdiocese in 2012, details Domeyer's concerns that the Archdiocese created a hostile work environment. In it, Dohmeyer says he considers the payments to be wrong, unethical, and illegal. Priests are either paid an annual salary or a pension upon retirement. Prior to his sentencing, Dohmeyer told NPR News that he considered the payments to be, quote, underhanded, especially after the Catholic Church made pronouncements a decade ago that it would be more transparent about child sex abuse.
For all the what they talk about, the accountability out there, you know, this stuff is still going on where they're still paying these guys. Some of them might not have been actually adjudicated, but they had credible evidence that something had went on and they're still paying them.
Dohmeyer says reasons for the payments included cover-up of alleged abuse. His memo alleges both sexual abuse against children and sexual affairs priests had with women. The Dohmeyer memo also alleges the archdiocese moved problem priests from one parish to another. Though Dohmeyer's credibility might be undercut by his conviction for embezzlement, his claims about extra payments are supported by another former top official in the archdiocese.
There was, like I said, a number of payments like this that I had uncovered.
Jennifer Hasselberger is a former canon lawyer for the archdiocese. Her role was to run the records department and provide advice on church law to Archbishop John Neinstedt. She resigned her position in April of this year. Hasselberger told NPR News that she had deep concerns about the payments going to priests alleged to be involved in misconduct. She said Catholics who give to the archdiocese would be concerned about this spending.
I think the average donation that comes into the appeal is like $200. And then to use that money for something like this is just so atrocious to me.
NPR News isn't identifying the names of the accused priests because they haven't been independently verified. A spokesman for the archdiocese did not answer questions about the allegations.
Tom Scheck there in St. Paul. Bankruptcies have been on the decline in Minnesota since spiking during the recession. So far this year, filings are about 35% below their 2010 peak. The reasons for the drop are complicated, and they're less tied to a recovering economy than you might think. Annie Baxter has this report.
Colin Mansfield hates owing money. In 2005, he had been unemployed for a few years. He burned through most of his savings and accrued crippling credit card debt.
It was about $30,000. It was a lot of money for me.
Mansfield could have gotten his debt canceled by going through bankruptcy. Without much of it, he was a good candidate. But instead, he decided to hunker down, pay off the credit card, and avoid a filing. He found ways to bring in money through a variety of jobs, including teaching and composing music. Here's a sample. Now at 64, Mansfield is penniless again. He can't find work and his savings account is empty. He draws disability payments from the government because of arthritis and depression, and he just started receiving food stamps. But this time, bankruptcy is not an option. It just wouldn't help Mansfield. He doesn't have any debt, and he absolutely refuses to borrow. He won't charge daily expenses to a credit card, even though he's desperately short on cash.
The idea of getting into debt again is frightening. I would do whatever I can not to do that.
Colin Mansfield's allergy to debt after owing tens of thousands of dollars helps explain why bankruptcies are plunging.
One of the reasons I think bankruptcies are declining right now is that people are not carrying a lot of debt on their household balance sheets. So there's just not a lot that bankruptcy can do for them.
Robert Lawless is a bankruptcy expert at the University of Illinois. He says during the recession, the foreclosure crisis played a big part in causing bankruptcy filings to spike. But foreclosures also ended up wiping out a lot of household mortgage debt. That happened at the same time that Americans pulled back on spending and borrowing money, if they could even get a bank to lend to them. As debt levels drop, so do bankruptcies. Lawless says it may seem odd, but improvements in the job market likely are not a factor reducing bankruptcies today.
People tend to look at bankruptcies as a measure of the overall strength of the economy, and I think that's usually a mistake.
Melissa Jacoby agrees. She's a bankruptcy expert at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and she says there can still be plenty of people in financial distress when the bankruptcy rate is low. Some people might not be able to afford filing. Reforms enacted in 2005 made it costlier. And Jacoby says bankruptcies actually tend to rise when an economy is soaring. Credit standards loosen, people spend more, and take on more debt.
One of the big peaks that people often commented on was in the mid-90s when filings first exceeded 1 million. And the big question then was how could filings exceed 1 million? at a time of such prosperity.
A recent study by the Federal Reserve Bank of New York shows that Americans are starting to feel more confident about taking on credit card debt again. And another Fed report says lenders are starting to make credit a little easier to come by. But for now, the slight change in attitude towards credit isn't helping Twin Cities bankruptcy lawyers. Attorney Ron Lundquist says client calls are down. And in a lot of cases, he's just helping customers sort through a bad financial situation instead of preparing a bankruptcy filing.
We can help them to get over where they are now and perhaps not get back into that situation in the future.
Lundquist says a growing share of his clients do have a huge amount of debt in the form of student loans. But that kind of debt is extremely difficult to dump in bankruptcy.
That's Annie Baxter on the NPR News Update. Now we close out the podcast with two stories about the environment. Did you know that only half of all cans and bottles used in Minnesota last year were recycled? Some state lawmakers want to boost that rate, and they say the way to do it is by making each container worth a dime. Several industry groups are pushing back. Here's Elizabeth Dunbar.
If you're charged an extra 10 cents for every can of soda, bottle of beer, or even gallon of milk you buy, would you be more likely to recycle the empty containers? State Senator John Marty says yes. The Roseville DFLer has been trying on and off since 1987 to get a container deposit bill approved in Minnesota, with no luck. But he thinks this time could be different after lawmakers directed the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency to do an in-depth study on it.
That was a big step forward because it was always so controversial nobody wanted to talk about it. It was hard to get committee hearings.
Marty says having people pay a deposit on their bottles and cans and then giving them convenient ways to get their money back could boost recycling of those containers.
The states that have had it have had very high container return rates. If people don't return them, people go around and pick up littered bottles and stuff and pick them out of the trash because it's valuable to them. It's been promised for years that people are going to learn and they're going to just start turning them in on their own. But if you set up a system where there is a deposit on each bottle, people do return them.
10 states have deposit laws, including Iowa and Michigan, and their recycling rates for cans and bottles are much higher. The Minnesota legislature directed the State Pollution Control Agency to come up with a general framework for the program. The plan calls for a 10-cent deposit on all beverage containers. It would include beer and milk, but not medicine, syrup, or baby formula. Consumers would pay the deposit when buying the beverage and could go to a designated redemption center for a refund. The program would be run by a nonprofit organization, not the state, and that group would have to ensure a convenient way for people to return their empties. But defining convenience was one of the questions that came up at a public meeting about the proposed program. Ryan O'Gara represents a couple of companies that do neighborhood waste pickup.
The question was phrased like, how far is too far to ask somebody to drive to get rid of their aluminum cans? I mean, my immediate response was, well, I can walk out in my garage and get rid of it right now. You know, if a system similar to this goes through, unless I'm willing to drive somewhere, I basically have to give up the 10-cent deposit that I put down on this container.
Waste management companies spoke out against the deposit program, and the companies that manufacture beverages also have concerns. Tim Wilkin, president of the Minnesota Beverage Association, says out-of-pocket costs for consumers would skyrocket with a 10-cent deposit. And he says people close enough to Wisconsin or the Dakotas would think twice about buying their drinks in Minnesota.
It's very easy to go from Moorhead over to Fargo, do your shopping there. Then Minnesota loses sales tax. They lose corporate income tax. They lose all sorts of revenues. And it's going to be very negative on those retailers.
Amid the discussion on the deposit law, some groups are pushing for a simpler, more centralized recycling system for the state. Right now, every city has its own program. Paul Gardner is a former DFL state senator who now directs a group called Recycling Reinvented. It's pushing for a statewide recycling system that's managed and paid for by industry groups.
It's always positive for government and the private sector to think about recycling more. So talking about container deposits or whether we should invest money in incineration of garbage or divert food waste, those are all very positive steps. We have to back up potential choices with data and talk with stakeholders to figure out the best way forward.
An in-depth cost and benefit analysis on a container deposit program is due to the legislature in January. Elizabeth Dunbar, Minnesota Public Radio News.
Honeybees are in trouble, and they have been for some time. The population is steadily declining. Pesticides and fewer flowering plants on the landscape are part of that problem. But disease and pests are also a growing threat to the bees. As Dan Gunderson reports, some beekeepers are trying to fight disease by improving bee genetics.
On a sunny early fall morning, Mark Sundberg visits bee colonies set up on the edge of woodlots or grasslands in Otter Tail County. Sundberg is a third-generation beekeeper near Fergus Falls. First, he fires up the smoker. Smoke calms the bees. Then he pries the wooden tops off the hives, checking for varroa mites. The tiny parasite attacks bee larvae and adult bees in the hive. For several years, Sundberg has been selectively breeding for what are called hygienic bees. They recognize sick bees and remove them from the hive. That cleaning helps break the mites' reproductive cycle.
It seems like some of the hives are figuring it out. Some you'll get to and they look great. Then there's something like that. It's horrible.
Sundberg just opened a hive and found no bees. He suspects mites killed the bees, despite the fact these hives were treated with an insecticide to kill mites. His next step is to see how widespread the infestation is. From a nearby healthy-looking colony, Sundberg shakes about 300 bees into a quart jar. Then he sprays ether into the jar, killing the bees and the mites. He hates doing this test, but when he dumps out the dead bees, tiny brownish dots pepper the sides of the glass jar. Those are the mites.
Six, seven, eight, nine, ten,
Sundberg counts more than 30, 13, 14, twice as many as he'd like to see.
I would conclude that the treatments aren't working very well. So this hive looks good now. If they die this winter, I'll know that it's probably because of the mites.
Sundberg says it's frustrating to see a dead hive next to an apparently healthy one, but he says that's actually part of the natural selection process he hopes will make bees healthier.
Quite frankly, some of the colonies need to die because they're not able to survive. And the ones that can survive, we need to reproduce from them.
By selecting for traits like the hygienic behavior, Sundberg says he's helping bees help themselves, but it's a painfully slow process. University of Minnesota bee expert Marla Spivak started the Minnesota Hygienic Bee Line. She says chemical treatments are no longer working for bee diseases and parasites, so the best solution is natural selection. If nature were left to its own devices, if beekeepers stopped using chemical treatments, Spivak says 80 to 90% of bees would die.
And after about 10 years, the remaining bees would develop resistance to these problems so that we would never have to treat again. But in the meantime, we wouldn't be able to pollinate the fruits and vegetables. So the trade-off is not realistic.
More beekeepers are now trying selective breeding. Spivak says that's a hopeful development. She says it's something that should have happened 20 years ago, but didn't.
And I think the reason is because it's too easy to buy a treatment. So they could purchase an antibiotic for the disease problem, or they could put a pesticide strip in the colony to control the mites. So it's taken a while for beekeepers to say, okay, all of these treatments are not really sustainable.
The U of M has bee teams that travel the country, helping beekeepers select for the hygienic trait. The U is just starting a study to measure the effectiveness of the bee breeding effort. Beekeeper Mark Sundberg thinks improved bee genetics has reduced or eliminated some disease problems in his hives. But Sundberg worries that while he's developing healthier bees, they won't survive a looming pesticide threat. Research is starting to show the popular neonicotinoid insecticide can kill bees or cause neurological damage.
With the neonicotinoids, we don't really fully know what the long-term effects are yet. And if everything's going to turn to corn and beans and the ground is poison, what am I doing here? Why am I bringing these bees here?
Sitting on the edge of a hive, Sundberg wonders if he'll be the last to operate the bee business started by his grandfather. Dan Gunderson, Minnesota Public Radio News, near Richville.
And that's all there is for the NPR News Update on this Tuesday. I'll have Wednesday's Minnesota News on your schedule tomorrow. Phil Picardi saying so long.